ready a little bit. Let's see if that's going to come up. Jimmy was supposed to be speaking this morning, but he's sick. So Friday night, Dave texted me and he said, Jimmy's sick, Sean's out of town, I'm out of town, and Kyle's leading singing. Would you like to preach? So you get the fifth choice this morning. Those of you who've been here for a while, you know one of the ways I like to talk, start out, most of what I do is with a little bit of humor. Part of that's because most of my life is spent around 11 to 14-year-olds, and you have to laugh to survive sometimes. But also because it's something that you kind of know. Laughter releases endorphins. Endorphins make you happy, and happy people learn better. My children are going to learn a lot when they get older. Now, for those of you who've been here for a while, this is going to be, sorry, Jaquan, a rehashed top 10 list. Two reasons. Number one, because I created a new one, and my wife didn't like it. She's like, it's not that funny. And number two, I figured, well, a lot of people haven't seen this one before, so we'll start. These are the top 10 useless inventions. Now, not all of these were actually ever taken to the point where they were made into a product. Some of them were. Some of them you will see why after the patent was filed for, why it never came to pass. Number 10, fireproof matches. It's fantastic. Number 9, a waterproof sponge. 8, double-sided playing cards. 7, inflatable dartboard. 6, a pedal-powered wheelchair. 5, glow-in-the-dark sunglasses. 4, a camcorder with braille-encoded buttons. 3, a parachute that opens automatically on impact. 2, a self-help book on how to read. And the number 1 most useless invention that was filed for, an ejection seat on a helicopter. When I was trying to come up with something that I wanted to talk about this morning, I went back to something I think that I spoke on about 6 years ago. And there's parts of it that I want to change because I see things a little differently now. That's kind of part of life. Several years ago, I did a mini little series on things that we say that we feel in the Bible that aren't really true. The thought this morning is this: then you can handle. You probably. When life is piling up on you, and people will say, well, the good thing is God will never give you more than you can. And to us it makes sense, and to us it's something that we can grab onto because it sounds fair. And we like fair. My 4-year-old will tell me all the time, that's not fair. My middle school students tell me, which is a good lesson that we like to give every now and then. Good, life's not fair. And really and truly, we're happy that in this case, it's not fair as well. Because if God was really fair with us on our behavior and on the things that we did, then we probably wouldn't be in the best shape. The fact is, we already talked about that. The fact is, this passage is taken from 1 Corinthians 10. And normally we just pull the chunk of verse 13 out of it. 13 says, "No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and He will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. But with the temptation, He will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it." The problem is we pull that verse out of context and try to slap on a meaning that makes us feel good. If we take the verses around it and we kind of read into it, starting in verse 6 instead of starting in 13, "Now these things that took place as examples for us, that we might not desire evil as they did. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. We must not indulge in sexual immorality, as some of them did. And 23,000 fell in a single day. We must not put Christ to the test, as some of them did, and were destroyed by serpents. Nor grumble, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example, but they were written down for our instruction, on whom the end of the ages has come. Therefore, let anyone think that he stands, take heed, lest he fall. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and He will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. But with the temptation, He will also provide the way of escape, that you may be able to endure it. Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry." See, here, as we take a little bit of time to textual analysis of what we're going on here, of what we've got going on here, this section is about temptation. Not necessarily about trials, not necessarily about adversity. Yes, temptation can lead to those things, but this is about temptation. And yes, He will provide escape so that we don't fall into sin. But the truth is, more than you can handle. There's a number of different passages we could look to. And this morning, the passage I decided to go to is 2 Corinthians, chapter 1, verses 8 through 10. "For we do not want you to be unaware, brothers, of the affliction we experienced in Asia. For we were so utterly burdened beyond our strength that we despaired of life itself. Indeed, we felt that we had received the sentence of death. But that was to make us rely not on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead. He delivered us from such a deadly peril, and He will deliver us. On Him we have set our hope that He will deliver us again." There's some things to point out from this verse. He says here that we were so utterly burdened beyond our strength that we despaired for life itself. But it was to make us rely on ourselves, not on ourselves, but on God. And on Him, we have set our hope that He will deliver us again. You see, as it says, God will very likely give you more than you can handle. He will not, however, give you more than He can handle. One of the thoughts that I had this morning, as I was thinking about what I wanted to talk about, took me back to the lyrics of a song that probably many of you have heard before. But the words are very powerful to me. It's a song by Mercy Me. And the song is "Even If." And we've all probably been in a moment where we could relate to this. It says, "They say sometimes you win some, sometimes you lose some. And right now, I'm losing both." It's easy to sing when there's nothing to bring me down, but what will I say when I'm even if you don't, my hope is you alone. They say it only takes a little faith to move a mountain. Well, good thing a little faith is all I have right now. But God, when you choose to leave mountains unmovable, oh, give me the strength to be able to sing, "It is well with my soul." I know you're able and I know you can. Save through the fire. And it goes on. Repeat some of that a little bit. We have those moments when we've been broken down. And when I've spoken here before, I've told you about some of those times in my life, and I'll do so again this morning, and I'll apologize in advance. I'm an emotional person. I can't help it. For the longest time, I tried to fight it, but it's just who I am. I'm not the type of person who likes to watch sad movies. Like, I don't leave it going, my emotions have been cleansed, I feel so fantastic. No, I'm sitting there watching the whole time going, when is the bad thing going to happen? Because I don't want to be here for it. So my apology isn't that I am an emotional person. It's that when emotions overtake me, it's really hard for me to talk. So if I pause for a moment, it's because I'm trying to battle back. So, you know, you don't stand and watch me for an awkward few minutes as I try to, you know, regain a grip on my sanity for a moment. When I preached on this last time, I told you about one of the darker moments of my life. But anyway, Sarah and I were engaged. We made a mistake about we were pregnant. And that was the beginning of a trial. And that was the beginning of a... reaching that moment where we had rebuilt it and we were getting through it, and I'll never forget it. I was in there and I was going to the first doctor's appointment. And it was a first-time sonographer doing the sonogram and everything like that. And Sarah's really excited because I've never seen this before. And she's like, there's the arm. She's like, yeah, and she's circling on the screen for us and everything's good. And then we're laughing, and then all of a sudden the doctor comes in. He goes, this is not what I expected. I'm like, what do you mean? Because we can't find a heart. And I remember it all coming over her. And she's like, how do we get it back? How can we get the heartbeat back? And he's like, you don't understand. It's not that way. She said, no, how do we get it back? And I'm sitting there and I understand that I can do, but I know I can't relate to the hurt that she's going through. And that's what I talked about that morning, about the brokenness. What I didn't know is after we would go down that same road again, you see, as we're talking through it, some of the things that I wanted to talk about, The sermon that I did before this is when we were announcing that we were dating again. And it was after I had done something about dealing with adversity and things like that. And about 3 weeks after that sermon, we're sitting again in the doctor's office. And the doctor tells us, I don't know how to tell you. You've lost the baby. And I remember being angry. I remember trying to come to grips with, why God, I see my wife broken. Why are you doing this? I see her saying, what? Giving me a child, and I see that. And I didn't know what to do with it. And then I would go to work, and because we worked together, and people didn't want to ask her, they would come to me and be like, how is Sarah doing? And every day it was like ripping the Band-Aid off again. And I remember sitting down with Sarah and saying, I can't do this again. I'm not strong enough. I can't fight this battle. And I remember just sitting around broken, walking through the motions, thinking in my brain, I've got to be able to handle this because God will not give me more than I can handle. What can I do? Me. I can't handle it. Why am I trying? Why am I letting myself be the one that tries to carry this burden? Why am I not giving this burden to God? And so that was a very hard time in our relationship. I didn't feel like I could take it. And she did. But God has a sense of humor. Anybody that has known my wife for a while knows that she's a big Disney fan. And we've never been to Disney World. And so I'm like, okay, let's save up. You know, we're at a very dark place. We're at a very challenging. Let's save up. Let's go take that Disney experience. Let's get our minds off of that. And so we started saving our money. And we finally had our money saved up. And we were planning on making that reservation. And I remember we were going to do it right for Christmas. And it was in December. And I remember walking past her as she walked out of the teacher's lounge. And she was holding a donut in one hand and a cheese stick in the other. And she was taking a bite out of one, then taking a bite out of the other. And I go, well, that's not normal. That's just not normal. And then we went out to eat that night with a group. And we're sitting there, and the teacher that's on one side of me has this salad that looks like they took an entire garden, chopped it up, and it's stacked high. And she's like, I don't think anyone could ever eat. Got the bowl held up. And it's like, scraping. And then she looks at my pizza and is like, are you going to eat the rest of that? Well, I was going to say, so even though we decided, or I had made the decision, that God, I can't take this anymore, God had different plans. And it reminded me, it reminds me of a passage, and I not at all want to compare myself to Paul here. So don't think that comparison's coming here. But this is a passage to me that when I get to the point of saying that I can't take it, that I can't handle it, woe is me, I read this. Therefore, so that I would not exalt myself, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to torment me so I would not exalt myself. Concerning this, I pleaded with the Lord 3 times to take it away from me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness. Therefore, I will most gladly boast all the more about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may reside in me. So I take pleasure in weaknesses, insults, catastrophes, persecutions, and in pressures because of Christ. For when I am weak, then I am strong. And kind of the overlying message is every weakness is an opportunity for God to show His strength in your life. And I think about that in times. I think about a conversation that I just recently had with John Edmonds when he was talking about the fire that he's gone through and that he continues to go through in his battle with cancer. And he's like, but what good is it? What is it? What was the purpose of God leaving? Things that Sean has told him is because when people say, how did you get through it? You said, the first thing you told us is, I didn't get through it. God brought me through it. And I think about those moments in lives when people say, how did you make it through that? And the times where I'm like, well, I've done this and I've done... No! I came through it because of God. Because it's not about our trials and tribulations. And this is kind of where I was going to end it, but it doesn't feel right ending it here, because the other side of this is in Galatians. Carry each other's burdens, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ. Because here's the thing. Constantly talking about, why are people leaving the church? Why are people going away? About it. For so long, we've sought to almost act out church, to say the right things, to sing the hymns, to listen to the message, to sit in Bible class, and to talk. And we've been so consumed of going to church that we forgot. God never told us to go to church. God told us to be. And that is being a family, and we've lost that. And we wonder why people are leaving. It's because people don't need a church building to go to. They need a family to be with. And as soon as we start recognizing, burdens are going to be a whole lot lighter, because I'm going to feel like I care because you care. You see, for years I was raised in a way, you do the right thing, you say the right thing, you be the Jesus that people expect you to be, that we never encountered the fact that this place is not wherever we carry our church with us. Needed to set all of this up. He knew we were perfect. He knew we were going to stumble. And so He laid a way for us to gain strength, to gain comfort. But when people walk into church buildings, it's not what they see. I remember very vividly when my wife and I first got married and we were visiting around churches, and I remember after a sermon was delivered and they asked, you know, just like a lot of churches do, if you have any need, please come forward. And someone came forward. And she just looked at me and she nudged me. She's like, why is someone not going with them? And I was like, what do you mean? She goes, why is someone not up there with them right now? Almost, it was half joking, half serious. I said, you know, here, when you come forward, it's the walk of shame. You've done something wrong, and now you must walk forward, you must sit there, and then afterwards we can come and love on you. And she goes, that's wrong. I said, well, I know. She said, that person is already broken. When they come forward, she said, I've been in places before. We've been praying for this person to see their wrong, to see everything. And she said, when we come in, we stop everything we're doing. It doesn't matter if we're in the middle of a verse of a song. The song leader says, stop, they're back. Everybody, let's pray for them. And that's family. And you see, if we want the church to grow, if we want our children and our grandchildren and our nieces and our nephews, if we want them to have university where I had a lot of friends and they were really good at going to church. And I remember sitting there thinking, man, I wish I had. And by the time they were 25, they could not stand the Bible. They could not stand the church. And they're as far away from Christ as they've ever been in their life because they were never taught how to be the church. And so when we talk about dealing with adversity, we talk about this idea, God will not give you He's going to take that burden away. But we do know this. He is preparing for us a place that is much better than here. And the other thing, God also understood that while it is important for us to pray, while it is important for us to understand here, He also knew that we needed someone here. And that's why He gave us each other. That's why we're called brothers and sisters and not members and members. And so, as we go through life, remember, your burdens are not your own. When you need help, ask for it. Our focus should be on returning to making this place family. And once we become the true church God intended, not only will we be pleasing to Him, but it will be something that others desire to be a part of. Now, all of this is because of Jesus. I kind of mentioned this morning around the table that so much depends on the fact that Jesus came in His perfection and walked this earth and took up the cross so that we could be reunited with God. if you've always known that you want that relationship and you've never made that decision, don't think that this is the only time that you can make this decision. Yes, this time is open to you. Yes, if you need help, this time is open to you. But every moment of every day is open to you. I guarantee you, there's not a person in here that if it's 3 a.m. and you're broken and you're battered and you're beaten and you need someone, call them. Now, if you call me, understand my coherency may take a little time to kick in. But once it kicks in, I'd be happy to help you with your burden. If you need anything this morning, come as together we stand and as we sing.
Trust the sweetest frame, but